Taking Aim with
Rev Shunman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, July 6th, 2004. Democratic nominee for President John Kerry announced today that John Edwards, the senator from North Carolina, will be his running mate for Vice President. John Kerry. Last week, in our first part of our show, One Big Property Party, we mentioned that earlier this month, John Edwards spoke at the high-powered and super-private Bilderberg meeting in Stresa, Italy. And at this meeting, two of the biggest figures in the Democratic establishment, who it was noted were neither of them big Edwards fans, came back raving about the performance of John Edwards, the senator from North Carolina. Did John Kerry choose John Edwards? His first choice, you will recall, was Senator John McCain. In fact, what we have is Wall Street, and the Wall Street establishment once again choosing who is going to be running. One Big Property Party. Ralph?
Well, the gravamen of this is very clear. Everybody is familiar with the Bilderbergers. Annually in Bilderberg land, which is a conference that initiated in Bilderberg, Germany, the captains of capital have a congress with their counterparts in various subordinate capitalist states, and they plan strategy together, and they allocate to each other respective components of the spoils. And as well, they describe and discuss who will the mouthpieces, the hired hands, be, who essentially audition before them. Clinton had done that with Pamela Harriman and the Bilderberg U.S. Contingent in the United States. They take their turns, but essentially they are hired hands. As the famous statement by Robert Townsend had it, they treat the country as their private whorehouse, and they look upon each successive president as a towel boy. That's from the former president of Avis and American Express.
Ralph, an article that appeared Wednesday, May 26th of this year, Wall Street Gives Millions to Bush, in fact describes very well how each of the two parties are funded and to who they serve. It's an article that appeared in the Washington Post by Thomas Edsel and Jonathan Weissman. Wall Street Gives Millions to Bush. President has backed legislation benefiting finance and insurance firms. And they note that at Merrill Lynch & Company, the chief executive, East Daniel O'Neill, is not to be taken lightly. In fact, he eliminated 24,000 jobs, froze pay, and he pushed out all his competitors for executive power. Ruthless is how he's described. But O'Neill sent a letter to all senior executives at Merrill Lynch in 2003. And at that time, he asked them to contribute to President Bush's reelection campaign in order to build a war chest early on. Between June 12th and June 30th, 18 days of 2003, the Bush-Cheney campaign was inundated with 157 checks from Merrill Lynch executives and 20 from their spouses. All 140 of the checks, almost all, were for the maximum allowed by law, $2,000. We spoke last week of bundling, and that's what Merrill Lynch's O'Neill was doing. The limit by law is $2,000. But then you write and have all your executives, their spouses, and their children donate so that in the less than 3 weeks, in 18 days, $279,750 was generated. But it didn't stop there. Merrill Lynch urged all its employees to contribute. And according to a firm, Dwight Morris & Associates, which studies political money, within a short period of time, they had contributed almost a half a million dollars. In fact, $12.14 million came into the Bush campaign from the finance and insurance sectors in 2003. Now, how did they benefit? You will recall the benefits were direct, with a cut in capital gains, the exemption of dividends from taxes, and that security firms earn their living from transactions on commissions. Then there was the repeal of the estate tax, so there was a direct benefit to Wall Street. And nine of Bush's Rangers, those who raise at least $200,000, nine of them are Wall Street executives.
Well, the article you're citing, Maya, is very specific about the particular relation of forces here. Wall Street shows its support for Bush because Bush has sponsored legislation producing billions of dollars in revenue on Wall Street. But that relationship is spelled out even more clearly, I believe, in an article by Lee Sustar. Using jobs as the excuse to give more money to the rich, Kerry catches tax cut mania. And in this article, it becomes clear that what we have is between the two parties of capital a division of labor of the following order. Wings of the Republican Party loot the Treasury, not just in the billions of dollars cited in the Wall Street Journal, but literally in trillions of dollars, which is what results in a $6 trillion increase in deficit. That is the consequence of essentially handing out a blank check to significant sectors of the class. Then the Democratic Party is brought into play to stabilize for the overall Wall Street and capitalist class the deficit financing that undermines the stability of the system in the short term. And then they proceed to effectively benefit the overall capitalist order by stabilizing with debt reduction, always at the expense of the working class. They don't roll back the kleptocracy's gains. They never touch them. On the contrary, they stabilize them, and they take the interim measures to gain a moment of respite and stabilizing of the overall capitalist order. But essentially, the cutting back in social services deepens the class war, and that is the job of the Democrats, to contain the working class and to sustain the alliance between the union bureaucracy and the capitalist class.
And that's why, Ralph, as we pointed out last week, the major supporters of both Kerry as well as Bush are the Wall Street and the captains of capital.
They pay for both parties and they sustain both policies because both policies are part of an overall strategic policy of stabilizing the looting of capital and the class war against the workers and the laboring masses that produce all value. In the article by Lee Sustar on April 2, 2004, he cites the March 26 speech by Kerry in Detroit, in which he declared that his plan was to cut taxes for business as the predicate for creating 10 million new jobs by giving tax incentives to companies to move their investments back to the United States and tax credits for companies that do so. But as has been pointed out in the Wall Street Journal and in other business publications, U.S. News and World Report, Business Week, and so on, this is a facade. What is real is the 10% tax rate, the one-time 10% tax rate that will be allotted to corporations that repatriate their profits to the United States. But what is essential to understand here is that the incentive for these vast conglomerates to hide their capital overseas, the incentive for them to send their capital overseas is not just the tax advantage. That's the dressing, the icing on the cake. The incentive is the slave labor wages, the 21 cents an hour that they pay to Haitian workers. or even the generous 69 cents an hour that the Zenith Corporation pays to Mexican workers and maquiladoras. This is what is consequent for them because it results in the hundreds of billions of dollars of profit, and the tax benefits don't induce them to do anything more than take advantage of them.
In fact, Ralph, what John Kerry is proposing, not only the 10% for 1 year gift to the 10% tax for repatriation of funds as a gift, he proposes lowering the overall corporate tax rate, lowering it by 5% so that it would go from 35% to 32.5%. What we have to realize is that there's been a shift in the United States, and that a shift from corporate taxes as an income generating stream for federal revenue to individual, putting the burden on individuals and their taxation, and that corporate taxes, according to the Wall Street Journal, are 7.6% of federal revenue in 2001, down from 23% of federal revenue in 1966. And if you look at the total figures, the total federal receipts were $1.8 trillion, and of that, $858 billion were from individual income tax, and individuals again paid for their retirement through Social Security, that's $700.8 billion. And there are then the corporate income tax, which are only $148 billion. If you also consider that individuals pay state government taxes and local taxes, such as sales tax and also state income taxes, and then parcel taxes on property, you can see that the major burden, the overwhelming burden of federal taxation is on the working class of this country.
Well, Maya, it's very clear. Robert McIntyre, Citizens for Tax Justice, spelled it out. The official corporate tax percentage of federal revenue at the beginning of 2001, that is to say, after the Clinton administration, was 7.6%, down from 23%. And so what you really have here, and of course these official figures don't account for the fact that the vast profits are sequestered in offshore accounts and never get into the tax picture at all, so it's a much smaller percentage than the official number. But you see, as the Sistar article makes clear, tax breaks do not spur job-creating investment, since the employers do not expand operations when facing overcapacity in almost every industry. And the utilization of industrial capacity has now hit a 20-year low as of the end of last year. So, in fact, instead of adding jobs, employers are squeezing more from fewer workers while allowing little or no wage growth. There was a cartoon in the Sunday New York Times which rather sums this up. It shows a figure standing in a box, and he says, "I lost my public service job as an engineer, but I'm told that there are many more jobs now being made available, and I know that's true because I got three of them." And then it shows this person on a bicycle delivering the Daily Bugle, wearing a hat with Taco Bell on the hat and a badge which says Walmart. And that's what we have here. Yeah, jobs are being created, part-time jobs with minimum wage, no benefits, no health care, no pensions. Forget the eight-hour day. These are people working three jobs. They're working 16 and 17 hours a day, and each of those jobs taken together doesn't give them the income they had from a union, well-paying job, which is a story of the past. So the jobs that they talk about here are the squeezing of the class, the rendering of income to a fraction of what people were earning before, and the profiteering continues apace on the backs of working people. That's the division of labor between the two wings of the capitalist class and the Republican and Democratic parties. And it's not only through the sham taxation schemes that this operation is conducted.
Ralph, let's look at what John Kerry has to say in relation to corporate profits and the expansion of corporate U.S. Corporate hegemony worldwide. Quote, "We need to export our capitalism and our democracy. They go hand in hand." And this is in reference to the debates. He made this statement during the presidential primary debates, and this statement about the relationship of capitalism democracy he mentioned in the Democratic debate in Columbia, South Carolina, May 3, 2003. In fact, John Kerry is a big fan of NAFTA, and he states categorically, "I supported NAFTA. I supported the WTO." He said this at Pace University here in Lower Manhattan, September 25, 2003. He thinks that free trade is essential. Remember, capitalism and democracy go hand in hand. And just like President Bush, he thinks that capitalism and democracy should be spread throughout the world. He's also in favor of fast-track authority. As you will recall, the labor movement had opposed fast-track. Fast-track enables the president to, without the congressional review, to implement free trade policies and other trade agreements throughout the world. John Kerry, in fact, wants to extend the Andean Trade Preference Act to for products from Colombia, Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador, because he says this will expand the reach of U.S. corporations. He voted to expand trade with 70 countries in Africa, Central America, and the Caribbean, expanding the U.S. hegemony, the U.S. corporate interests, but without reference to what takes place in the countries of Africa, Central America, and the Caribbean, such as Haiti, with the sweatshops that are imposed, with the control of banking, with the buying up of the land and the other resources in Mexico, the taking away of the ability of the peoples of these countries to have control over their own lives. John Kerry, he's for the corporate interests. He's not considering the issues of the working peoples internationally. No, he says yes on expanding trade throughout the world. Yes, create the free trade agreements. In other words, the agreements that are in the direct interests of the corporate U.S. interest, the U.S. corporate interest.
Well, Maya, these programs have been crafted by a Wall Street regular, Roger Altman.
Altman,
and the American Enterprise Institute, which is the essential institution of the neocons and the right wing of the Republican Party, has given its complete blessing to the Kerry tax program. Kerry is positioning himself as a pro-business Democrat, writes Jim Vandehei, Washington Post, March 26, 2004, similar to Bill Clinton, and to beat back charges that he is a tax and spend liberal. What does this rhetoric mean? As Kerry's economic team has been rolling out its new plan, it is made clear that what they will be doing is cutting social services. Every time that they obtain a tax cut for business, they counterpose that to the cutting of social services. Quote, "The most salient feature of the corporate tax rate cut," said Roger Altman, a top economic advisor to Kerry, "is that it will be spend as you go. You can only spend when you have made a fiscal accounting for the spending, which is counterposed and counterbalanced by a further saving for the corporate world." So, in fact, what you really have got here is the task assigned to the Democrats to do what the Clinton administration accomplished before: cut back on welfare, cut back on social services, downsize government, eliminate all of the public funding of the support apparatus for working people, meager as it was. R. Bruce Jostin of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce stated that the Kerry Plan addresses the complexity of the global economy. And indeed, Clinton and the Congressional Democrats offer a mix of tax cuts as the centerpiece of an economic plan that is setting the stage for social cuts, which is indeed the very program that Altman of Wall Street has put together for a Kerry administration.
What's interesting, Ralph, is they talk about reducing the size of the federal government. In fact, what they do is they increase the federal budget and use the federal government as a pass-through for corporate interests. In other words, eliminate the federal jobs with pensions and health benefits and civil service, which enables people to have contracts so that they don't get hired and fired at will. But they use the funds that come from the working class of this country, and then the government is a pass-through to the corporate interests with sweatshop conditions. Pay-as-you-go government. The name of the fiscal responsibility of the Democrats that was developed by Gene B. Sperling, who was President Clinton's National Economic Advisor, Director of the National Economic Council, and he was the third person to hold the position of the Chief Economic Advisor in the White House, following Robert Rubin, one of the heads of Citigroup now, and Laura Tyson on her way to the Federal Reserve. Now, Gene B. Sperling is a very interesting character because, Ralph, he's the one who implements what you were describing about reducing social services and the maintaining the stability of corporate interests. Fear not, he said, Kerry said, I am not somebody who wants to go back and make the mistakes of the Democratic Party of 20, 25 years ago. He said this in April. I am not a, quote, redistributive Democrat. Not a redistributive Democrat, meaning that he's not interested in the social services. But in fact, he is a redistributive Democrat, redistributing the wealth of this country to the wealthy. A good example is on education. Kerry had made a campaign promise to beef up preschool education, increase aid to cities and states. And in fact, as soon as Gene Sperling came on board, the first thing he did was to scale it back, saying clearly that college aid is important, however, it has to be paid for, and the funds are not there to fulfill the promises of John Kerry. Ralph?
In the Boston Globe, on April 17th, Peter Canellos spells out what you're describing. Quote, education advocates got a rude shock Wednesday when they logged on to johnkerry.com, the candidate's much-touted plan to provide free college tuition to those who commit 2 years of national service. It has been wiped off the screen, replaced with a 74% reduction in a scaled-down version. And once again here, Gene Sperling, the Clinton economic chief who co-authorized Kerry's plan to reduce the deficit, pressed the delete key. He advised the presumptive Democratic nominee, it was pay-as-you-go government, putting fiscal responsibility ahead of spending hikes on education, housing, and local aid. Local aid meaning social services to starved cities, counties, and states. Fear not, as you say, I am not someone who wants to go back. Well, the going back means supporting social services at a minimum level. And indeed, the Boston Globe article, expanding on what you've described, cites Bruce Reed, who is the president of the DLC, which is the leading Democratic body that represented the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. Kerry has always been a reformed Democrat, a solid new Democrat, And what is this rhetoric? Fiscal discipline. Fiscal discipline. The economic plan is a victory for centrist Democratic policy makers who lean towards Edwards and Joseph Lieberman, and even Kerry supporters concede that it's a defeat for, quote, liberals, unquote, including some in the Kennedy camp. So he's committed himself to be a pay-as-you-go figure, spending initiatives measured against their impact on the deficit. The deficit derived from vast increase in military expenditure, which he, Kerry, supports, and consequently, spend-as-you-go means cutting social services, let alone expanding them. Every area other than national security will be capped at the rate of inflation, meaning that all programs for AIDS prevention, housing, education, social services will be budgeted only on the basis of pay-as-you-go, and the net result, the Boston Globe article spells out, will be cuts. Cuts and reduction. Different spending priorities here. Kerry's fiscal restraint may help him get elected and will secure him the support of Wall Street, the Boston Globe concludes.
And for those of you who think that John Kerry has the health care of the 44 million uninsured, that he's taking it to heart and that he's going to do something about it, take heed of the pay-as-you-go, because the largest domestic policy initiative proposed by John Kerry was his health insurance package. And the Washington Post, on June 28, 2004, in an article, The Choice for Voters, Health Care or Tax Cuts, stated that John Kerry's health package would cost between $653 billion and $950 billion over 10 years, supposedly providing coverage for 27 million additional people, and have the federal government take over from the insurance companies the most expensive, that is, the catastrophic illness insurance coverage that drives up the insurance rates for business. In other words, shifting the most expensive to the federal government. He also proposes tax credits and personal savings accounts to cover an additional $2.5 billion. Now, again, you must look at the cost, the $950 billion over 10 years, because John Kerry can talk about expanding health care, but when it actually comes to paying for it, and at the same time to pay for the additional military and the military adventures that he also proposes, his economic advisors, such as Gene Sperling and Robert Rubin, are going to say, sorry, folks, we have our priorities. Ralph?
Let's look at this with a historical context. As the Boston Globe and the Wall Street Journal make clear, quote, Kerry always goes the extra mile. He cast the crucial vote for Clinton's bill dismantling welfare for poor mothers and children in the United States. The Clinton-Gore slashing of welfare and social services, the crucial vote was that of John Kerry. And like Joseph Lieberman, Kerry markets himself as a cultural conservative and chides teenagers about the kind of clothes they wear, the music they want to hear, and the movies they watch. Even Lieberman did not go so far as to support the Communications Decency Act, which Kerry backed. Even this conservative Supreme Court struck down the law, ruling that it trampled upon the First Amendment. But these cultural reflections of the capitalist loyalty of Kerry are but the decorative embellishment, because his top advisor, Rand Beers, who we described last week, who crafted Plan Colombia, the brutal war on the Andean peasants and waged for the benefit of the oil companies, the Rand Beers Kerry plan, with its emphasis on energy conservation, facilitates offshore oil leasing, natural gas drilling, transcontinental pipelines, strip mining for coal, And that particular policy is Rand Beers, scripted by Wall Street bond tycoon Robert Rubin, and it is even more austere than that which was implemented under Clinton and Gore, which in their first 2 years undertook more drastic cuts in social services than in the combined 8 years of the Reagan administration.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener supported and non-commercial.
I now see the hand of capital, the role of the Democratic Party as the handmaiden of the capitalist order's disciplining of the working class.
Ralph, as you said, in September 1995, John Kerry had voted yes on the Clinton proposal of welfare to work. But even more than that, he supports block grants to states, which would provide the states with a set amount of money with that they would have to spend on those who need aid. And it's instead of the aid to individuals being based upon whoever needs it, and it's a joint project of the states and the federal government, instead the states would have a set amount of money and they would have to budget within that amount of money, and that means that they would have to deny people coverage. John Kerry has also come out to say that he would actually like to end welfare and replace it with a job opportunity program. Well, let me tell you about some of these job opportunity programs. An organization with which I work, Planning for Elders, has a program where it works with home care workers, particularly those in the private sector. And many of these, what we're seeing is an influx of Filipino women. Now, these women had jobs previously. They were security screeners at the airports. But as you recall, President Bush laid off immigrants, undocumented immigrants, at the airports. And en masse, particularly in San Francisco, the new Filipino immigrants, the Filipinos, lost their job, predominantly women. So the government provided them with job training, and they trained them for low-end home care work to become CNA, Certified Nursing Assistants. Well, the government may think overall this is a growth industry, but none of these women have been able to find work. Laid off, retrained, no work. And this is the type of proposal that John Kerry supports, instead of having the government subsidy of welfare. Let's look at John Kerry's position on choice. An important article came out in the Associated Press, Ron Fournier, Wednesday, May 19th. Kerry opened to anti-abortion judges. It's very important because Roe v. Wade, for which there was a long struggle, has been tested over and again in the courts, particularly at the Supreme Court level. And John Kerry himself voted to confirm Antonin Scalia, who is open in his opposition to Roe v. Wade. This was in 1986. And John Kerry came out and said that he would support anti-abortion judges. He was challenged by Planned Parenthood, which has been supporting John Kerry, as well as NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Organization. And so John Kerry backpedaled and said, well, I leave open the possibility of appointing anti-abortion judges to lower courts. In fact, his statement that he would support anti-abortion judges originally, and he left it open to the numbers on the courts that would maintain Roe v. Wade. Is this how he makes his decisions? He's either pro-choice or he's not pro-choice. And if he's pro-choice, he's going to support only judges who will maintain a position to defend women's rights. Not John Kerry.
Well, there is no commitment to sustaining anybody's rights here. This is basically doublespeak. Let's take a rather classic example of that doublespeak from the New Republic, which takes us into the arena of national security. The first Gulf War was one for which John Kerry voted. He received a letter which expressed opposition to this, and this is how he responded to that letter. "I share your concerns. On January 11th, I voted in favor of a resolution that would have insisted that economic sanctions be given more time to work and against the resolution giving the president the immediate authority to go to war." This was a letter that was sent to him by Wallace Carrer of Newton Center, Massachusetts. He then received another letter from the same person in which the letter writer expressed support for the Gulf War. Previously, his letter to Kerry, which elicited that comment about preferring sanctions and giving more time, was the response to the letter which was opposing it. Now the same man writes a letter in support of it. "Thank you very much for contacting me to express your support for the actions of President Bush in response to the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. From the onset, I have strongly and unequivocally supported President Bush's response to the crisis and the policy goals he has established with our military deployment in the Persian Gulf," wrote John Kerry. The diametric opposite to the same inquirer. That's the shell game. They continue to support the policies of the ruling class, the expansion of the military, imperialism abroad, national security and repression at home, tax cuts for the rich, social services to be slashed.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Our program today, One Big Property Party. Over the years, we've been saying there's one big property party with two names. What John Kerry is doing with the Democratic Party is to eliminate the two names. He believes, and the people who support him, the New Democrats, that in fact it's only one big property party. So much for two-party, or they've eliminated the possibilities of a multi-party system, which we all support, and instead they have their one big property party. Ralph.
Kerry, huge increase in security apparatus. John Kerry unveils comprehensive plan to fight the war on terrorism in a speech today. This is February 27th in 2004 on the Kerry website. In a speech today at the UCLA International Institute, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry offered a comprehensive approach to fighting the global war on terrorism. And in a second series of speeches on national security, Kerry presented a plan to identify, disrupt, and eliminate all support networks for terrorism using all the resources at our disposal. And then he stated, "We are threatened by a far-flung network that will continue to operate even if bin Laden is caught and al-Qaeda eliminated." John Kerry addressed the Council on Foreign Relations and outlined a global vision to make the United States more secure with expanding the war on terror both at home and abroad. He will act militarily when necessary, build alliances with other nations, enhance our intelligence, and expand the reach of American power. Terrorism exists now in 60 countries. For today, the agents of terrorism work and lurk in the shadows of 60 nations in every continent. We shall meet and triumph in suppressing this and in crushing it. Direct military action, military force, will be used to capture and destroy terrorist groups and their leaders in any host country where they exist. We'll increase active duty strength and tailor forces to be better prepared for these conflicts wherever they have to occur.
Ralph, as Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader and Congresswoman from the San Francisco Bay Area, had stated explicitly in response to President Bush's State of the Union address, in January, the Democratic Party is actually more conservative, more to the right of President Bush on national security, so-called national security. In other words, suppressing our civil liberties. In fact, as John Kerry supported and said in response to President Bush's radio address on April 16th, he made the following statement, quote, I believe that strengthening our anti-terrorism laws is critical to protecting our nation. When it comes to protecting our homeland, we must act decisively and swiftly. The Patriot Act, however, does not do that on its own. That's in keeping with what you mentioned with the UCLA address, and he is very explicit about how he would reinforce the Patriot Act, not eliminating the Patriot Act, I say, once again, reinforcing and expanding. And this is how he would do it. He's, in fact, President Bush and the Republicans are just not doing enough, to control the people of the United States. John Kerry would create a Homeland Security Corps, and this would give local communities the resources to hire additional law enforcement officials trained specifically in Homeland Security. Again, he would also create something like a civil defense corps. Does everyone remember the plan of the Bush administration that much public outcry suppressed about having vigilante groups in neighborhoods who would spy on people? Well, John Kerry supports this plan. Ralph.
Kerry says Bush ignoring imminent threats. This is in the Free Republic on the 30th of April, in which the constant reference to the inevitability of a massive terror attack on the United States, another false flag operation by 9/11, is invoked. And this time it is Kerry who is sounding this alarm, and that raises a very interesting question. Because what you have here is competing banjos. Sounding the theme of the inevitability of a terror attack, the assumption has been made that this would be an attack deployed to preempt an election and cancel the elections. Well, in fact, a major sector of the ruling class that is opposed to sustaining the Bush administration is preparing for just such an event, not before the election, but after it. Kerry says Bush is ignoring the imminent threats amid warnings that another devastating terrorist attack on the United States is imminent. John Kerry accused President of leaving Bush of leaving the nation's chemical plants vulnerable because of his political ties to the industry. And he calls for a new intelligence czar and for a single coordination of all intelligence to intensify repression in the United States. That is the gravamen of the Kerry response to the constant talk of an imminent terrorist attack, to state that, yes, there will be an imminent terrorist attack, and we're going to prepare for it now.
Ralph, it's the dueling banjos. They are competing, the dueling banjos. And again, about John Kerry and beefing up, reinforcing federal intervention in our lives, intelligence intervention, not federal intervention with jobs programs and health care. Kerry will improve information sharing between the federal intelligence officials and local law enforcement officers. In other words, he proposes to give state and local authorities access to the 58 national terror lists, create 24-hour operations center in each state to provide a real-time link between federal and law enforcement. He's more specific. He said, we're years behind schedule with the FBI and the immigration fingerprint databases being merged, and that provides a real risk that terrorists and other serious violent criminals are permitted entry. He also supports the smart border, that is, increasing the vigilance at borders, the virtual border network, in fact, where people are investigated prior to coming into the United States, and he would provide new security measures at all the border crossings and expand the reinforce the border patrols. Again, he says that the terrorist threat integration center, which combines the CIA, FBI, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the National Security Agency, the Coast Guard, Homeland Security, and the Secret Service, isn't adequately funded, and that the agencies are not sharing enough information. That, in fact, their databases should be combined in a terrorist screening center, and this database should be expanded.
Five twenty-six oh four USA Today. John Kerry supports 95% of the Patriot Act, and he would strengthen the other sections. So he is criticizing Bush from the right. He is accusing the Bush administration of not going far enough towards carrying out a war on terror, and of handing over that responsibility to the military, the National Guard, to police U.S. cities. Senator John F. Kerry said today he would expand the active duty army by 40,000 soldiers, including a doubling of U.S. special forces, speed development of new technologies and equipment to meet the threat posed by terror networks, and to integrate the National Guard in the nation's homeland security strategy. Now, let's be very clear about what this means. At the moment, the National Guard is being deployed in Iraq. At the moment, the units that have been part of the Army Reserves and Marine Reserves and Air Force Reserves and Navy Reserves are not only being used in Iraq, but when their term expires, they are being forced to continue it. Kerry calls for additional 40,000 troops and the deployment of these National Guard units as the policing operation within the United States. Because of the imminent terror attacks and because of the inevitability of these attacks, which obviously is something that is being not just contemplated but planned by both wings of this ruling class, the fake division of Republicans and Democrats, Kerry responds to President Bush's radio address on April 17, 2004, "We shall vastly intensify the Patriot Act with a director of national intelligence, consolidating the various security agencies and ensuring that the systemic weakness that existed before 9/11 will be addressed." This is, in fact, a program for martial law in the United States. The National Guard's specific responsibilities on the Kerry website to, quote, make America stronger and safer will be, and here it is, a central mission of the National Guard with respect to homeland security, will be to quarantine people, oversee medical units, set up and execute plans for detention, and for implementing the forced vaccination when required after the anticipated chemical and biological attack within the United States. AmeriCorps will be doubled, its mission expanded to include homeland security, framed to overtake, under the National Guard, emergency medical responses and other homeland security operations. Who is to be one of the point people in this operation? None other than former Naval Commander William J. Crow. William J. Crow was not only Clinton's ambassador to Great Britain. He had a more significant role as well. In conjunction with the Carlyle Group, William J. Crow was in charge of BioPort, which was the manufacturer of the anthrax vaccines, and the imposition of these vaccines upon U.S. Gulf War personnel is associated with the neurological disorders that have afflicted hundreds of thousands of Gulf War veterans. William J. Crow, linked not just to the defense industry and the Carlyle Group, but to the pharmaceutical industry, bridging the Democratic administration of Clinton and then of Bush and now of John Kerry, is associated with the use of pharmaceutical weapons and biological weapons, both within the United States and indeed through Port and Downs in Great Britain, and the Port and Downs transfer of the development of anthrax and other biological weapons, which were tested on civilians both in Great Britain and the United States, was coordinated not just by William J. Crow, but by the Al-Hibris. The Al-Hibris, who were associated with Bioport and Port and Downs, were also part of the apparatus of the BCCI and the funding of the Bush companies, Harkin Energy. This is one happy family of a ruthless ruling class. William J. Crow now being brought into the picture through from Clinton, through Bush, now through Kerry, in relation to Homeland Security and the militarization of the policing of the American people in the anticipated attacks that the ruling class has been promising us every 5 minutes.
Last week, Ralph, in the first part of One Big Property Party, we spoke of policing the world and John Kerry's commitment to preemptive attacks and also maintaining troops throughout the world, in fact, increasing the military strength. Let's look at a particular part of his foreign policy, and that is the relation to the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and his support of the Zionist state of Israel. David Halbfinger, March 1, 2004, The New York Times wrote a revealing article. In meeting, Kerry emphasizes his strong support of Israel, but how did he express it? That's what is very revealing. Senator John Kerry told dozens of Jewish leaders in New York on Sunday, February 29th, that he would continue the Bush administration policy of vetoing any United Nations security resolutions seen as one-sided against Israel. And Kerry was more explicit. He had supported the barrier wall, the wall that is encircling Palestinian villages, a de facto taking over of Palestinian land, an attempt to expel the Palestinians without directly expelling them by making life so that it is not viable in the Palestinian communities. And John Kerry has come out in support of the wall. Ralph.
This was elaborated in an article by Ashraf Fahim in the Beirut Daily Star on June 1st. Quote, a raft of statements by Kerry lauds President George W. Bush's unequivocal support of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. He has endorsed Sharon's Gaza disengagement plan. John Kerry has endorsed George Bush's commitment to Sharon's retention of large sections of the West Bank. And Kerry has expressed support for Israel's assassination of Palestinian leaders, the construction of the separation barrier, and the isolation and removal of Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. In fact, the positions of John Kerry not just echo those of Bush and of the Likud, but they promise to go beyond them. Indeed, at the time of the assassination of Rantisi, the Hamas leader, John Kerry not only expressed support for the assassination and the targeting of Palestinian figures for assassination, but he made an explicit statement in which he said on NBC television Meet the Press, I support the assassination of Rantisi. Israel has every right to respond to terror. And he said they refused, does Hamas and others, to support a peace process, and I support Israel's efforts to make itself more secure. Open and explicit and specific support for the program of assassination of the Sharon regime and of the Zionist state by John Kerry. And that is consonant with the statement and the description of the positions of Kerry in the Sydney Morning Herald on May 20th, 2004, in which he stated that the United States will remain in occupation of Iraq at least for the next decade. He then said that they would be out of the death zone by the end of his first term, meaning 2008, but that U.S. troops would not only be in occupation of Iraq at least for the next decade, but there would be an expansion of the U.S. global presence, and he specified Saudi Arabia and Iran. Indeed, it's interesting to note that Richard Nixon used similar language during the 1968 presidential race when he said he had a plan. He had a plan for the removal of troops at the end of his term. We know what that meant with Richard Nixon in Vietnam. It is identical to what the Kerry people have in mind with respect to the Middle East. But let me say this. Kerry has gone on record as saying it is necessary to, quote, stop Hugo Chavez, who has, quote, repeatedly undermined democratic institutions by using extra-legal means and has a relationship with Fidel Castro that raises serious questions about the desirability of allowing him to remain in power. The international community cannot allow Chavez to subvert democracy. He must be pressured to comply with the agreements and forced to do so, says Kerry. From North Korea to Venezuela to Iran to Saudi Arabia to the increase of 40,000 troops in Iraq to the assignment of 100,000 police to the expansion of the National Security Patriot Acts in the United States. These are the policies of a ruling class, whether before an election or after an election. The elements of the police state are being prepared. Repression at home, elimination of social services, enriching of the corporations and cutting their taxes, the so-called fiscal responsibility of stabilizing the capitalist state on the backs of working people can only be accomplished by troops abroad, a new conscription, and repression at home. One big ruling class control of the American population. Resistance is our responsibility.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, One Big Property Party, Part 2. Parts 1 and Part 2 will be on our archives on our website, www.takingaim.info. We'd like to hear from you. Contact us at takingaim@pacbell, that's PACBELL.net, or takingaim@WBAI.org. You can reach us by U.S. mail at P.O. Box 6345 Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California 94591. We also have cassettes and CDs of our programs. Contact us for these. We'll be with you next week.